Blog Talk Radio.
Blessed souls, here it comes, the 126th class of Getting to the Heart of the Matter, Soul Class number 126. Good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are in the world. This is your cyberspace humble Torah activist, Dunzus Hugh Goodman. And let's talk about what this show will be about right now. Blessed is our Creator. Blessings and greetings, blessed souls. We all know that you know, we know, everyone knows life should be more qualitative for all people. Typical and atypical. That is why we continue with our radio tutorial with human rights activist Rabbi Eliezer Dr. Goldstock, who has recognized over the past 21 years with the assistance and guidance of his wife of valor, Chana, that changing an attitude must lead to a change in one's actions and hopefully in a more quantitative and qualitative manner. We hope to continue to vibe out on Goldstock's efforts to build a center in Jerusalem to assist Jewish families sort through the massive logistics of moving to Israel, not only for themselves, but for their atypical children who are uniquely connected to the Most High Creator and waiting patiently for the rest of us typical human beings, unquote, quote unquote, human beings, to get the message we're the ones truly needing rectification, not them. We have live on the line Rabbi Goldstock. Eliezer, good morning to you.
Well, good morning. Rev. Don Zusha Goodman, Chassid, Atzadik, a mensch.
Well, I like. And I want to say. I like to say.
What?
I like to say I'm a work in progress. That's
well,
how I like to
look
at myself.
That doesn't take away from any of the other nice things that you are. You know, it's an interesting thing because Albert Einstein once said that when the solution is simple. Then there is God giving you the answer. So it's a very simple thing, you know. wonderful at the things you're wonderful at, and you're working on the things that you're not wonderful at. That's where I am.
Okay, let's jump right into the pot. The water's boiling. We might as well get our skin a little reddish pink and invite everyone to get into this mode of thought we want to get into. Eliezer and Blessed Souls listening out there, and maybe later on the show, halfway through the show, if you want to call to make the show a little organic, you can call 347-838-8669. What I share with Rabbi Goldstock, I want to share with you now, Blessed Souls. This morning I was before my prayers in the Frankel Shul over here in Kessler Crown Heights, Brooklyn, New York, here in the United States of America, and I came across a teaching from the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, which is taught very tersely, but it's a very powerful teaching. Tracha v'tzayin, good thinking, it will be good. And the third Lubavitcher Rebbe's descendant, the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rebbe of our generation, Rebbe Menachem Mendelssohn, elaborated that a good thought has to translate into good speech, and how much more so into good action. So that my first question to you is, Eliezer, is the idea of a good thought and good speech and good action, how does that relate to the whole concept of heart-to-heart American? Your organization, of course.
Well, I think that's the whole basis of the organization. It's a good thing that you saw that this morning in the minor that you were probably learning. The Rebbe has often said that... first of all, let me just back up one step before we get to Trachud Vetzayngud, because the whole world is predicated on that concept. We just miss that. The world is infinite, and if I would just take a moment to reiterate the difference between infinite and a long distance. If we take somebody who has $1 million, and we compare him to a person who is a billionaire or a trillionaire, a Bill Gates 10 times over, there is still a distance between the millionaire and Bill Gates's amount of money. It's a great vast divide, but there's a long distance. If I say, however, that somebody is worth whatever they are, and make some standard, a brilliant person with an IQ of 100, a brilliant a not so brilliant person of an IQ of less than 100, or a really brilliant person of an IQ of 200. Between that and infinite, there is no connection, because infinite means there's no end. Not only is there no end, there's no beginning. So if we look at it that way, we really understand fully that we are in a world of infinite reality and infinite possibilities. For example, if you look into the stars in the heaven, we will see that there is no end to what we're looking at. We think that we've come to a place where there's black holes, where there's openings in this and that, but that just leads to something else, and that will lead to something else, and so forth and so on. God gave us an example of infinite in our reality. There's never been two children or two people in the history of the world, and will never be, that are exactly the same. That's an infinite number of possibilities that is continuing to re-manifest itself on a daily basis. So why do we assume that the body is any further from Hashem than the neshama? Is Hashem just lying around in some spiritual space outside this world? Is God everywhere?
He's everywhere.
In other words, if you come to a conclusion in your life that Hashem is a certain thing, then you've limited God.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly God could never be encapsulated in a body, for example, there's no way that you could physically contain Hashem, because even when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Har Sinai to get the Ten Commandments, the Luchos, the Ten Commandments, he never saw Hashem. He only saw the back of his tefillin, and
right.
He really there only saw what was written on the tefillin. The point is that Hashem, in the essence of what is Hashem, could never be contained in anything physical. However, we live in this simple, hidden world, Helam, it's a hidden place. And we have to come to find the realities of being there. Last week we were talking about what happened when I made a speech in the shul in Muncie, and all of our friends who had special children came to our house, and it was the first time we realized in the short period of time that we had been living in the community that there were other people besides us who had special needs children. So as a result of that, someone in our community, and I still to this day don't know who, contacted me, and I don't know if I tell the story about the first night that it was in the middle of the night, we got a phone call, and I grabbed some flowers off of the, shop.
Not on the show, so let's start, okay, so maybe rewind and take us from the beginning again, that story.
Okay, we're doing a do-over? Okay.
Yes.
Cut
take
that,
two.
Everybody. Just forget what I said. Okay, so that evening when we got a phone call in the middle of the night about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning from an anonymous source who said that they would like to remain that way for professional reasons and personal reasons, that there was a family that was in a hospital in Columbia, Babies Hospital, which was upper Manhattan, probably of the hospitals in Manhattan, the closest one to where we were in Muncie. So I said, yeah, and they said, and they're having a problem accepting the fact that the child was born with Down syndrome. I said, wow, you know, that's something I know a little bit about. So I said, they gave me the details, and they said, please just, you know, don't mention me at all. And I said, of course not. So I got up, and I told my wife, I asked her what we should do, Hannah, and she said, well, you know, you're telling everybody that, you know, they should keep their children. Maybe, you know, we need to go, you know, you need to go start talking to them. So I said, okay. So I got up and I grabbed the flowers off of the table in the dining room. Every Shabbos, I, you know, bring my wife flowers for Shabbos to beautify the table. And I took those flowers and wrapped them in some paper, and I jumped in the car and ran to the hospital. And I got there, I don't know, it was about 3:15, 3:30 in the morning. Still dark. It's like the darkest part of the night, you know, the dark before the day. And I wiggled my way past the security guard. I don't remember even how I did that one. And got into the onto the ward, and I walked into the room, and I had a big bright smile and a bunch of flowers in my hand, and I said, Mazel tov, Mazel tov, I heard you had a little boy, because I noticed that it said baby boy, whatever the family was. And they both turned around and looked at me, and were, first of all, there's a word they use in England called gobsmacked, which means like totally befuddled, just totally surprised. They were gobsmacked. So I said, listen, I heard you had a baby boy, and I just, you know, I couldn't wait to come and wish you Mazel Tov. And the father of the baby turned to me and he said, didn't you hear? I said, hear what? He said, the baby's sick. So I said to him, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I said, I heard that the baby had Down syndrome. I didn't realize that the baby was sick. And that completely threw everything off. And the mother said to me, what do you mean? And I said, well, the baby has Down syndrome. That's you know, that's something you can deal with. But the baby's sick. You know, maybe you need to call in some specialists. And the father said, no, he's retarded. And he's, you know, and all these things. So I said, and then the father started a mantra that lasted the whole evening or morning. How did you find out about this? And I said, I just found out. I mean, somebody, you know, in the course of the evening, I just heard. He says, come on, we just had the baby like 2 hours ago. How did you find out? And he continued that mantra all evening. So I turned to him. The wife finally, you know, started to agree with the husband because he was so adamant about it. And she says, yes, how did you find out? So I looked at them and I said, you guys have been firm all your life, huh? You've been religious Jews all your life. I said, and you've lived in the firm world. Have you ever known of a secret in the world of firm people that stayed a secret longer than the first 20 seconds? And they both kind of looked at me and agreed, you know, like, oh, of course. It was like, of course that's, you know, everybody knows everybody's business. So it just became like that kind of put the whole thing to rest. And then we started talking about what is Down syndrome and what is this and what is that. And the father was adamant. He didn't want to take the baby home. He didn't want to have to deal with it. And the mother, of course, as is every mother, was totally attached to this baby because this baby, after all, incubated within her as and became a part and process of part and parcel of the process of becoming human and becoming a soul, in the neshama, through this infinite experience that we call life. And she was a little less excited about, you know, bailing out and giving up. And yet, nonetheless, the husband's, while he was still very frustrated and still, even as I left there that morning, still wanted, you know, he said, you know, just tell me, you know, just between us, you know, how'd you find out? You know, that was it. Was the only thing that was bothering that he had a child with Down syndrome. It seemed like to me he was about to accept that because that wasn't what bothered him. I mean, it did bother him. It was the primary challenge in his life at that point. But more overriding was, how did I find out and where did I come from? And you know, I said, did you ever see the Lone Ranger? He said, well, yeah. And I said, well, if I had a silver bullet, that's what I'd do. I'd leave that with you. Anyhow, I left there that morning, and they were still up in the air. And we eventually rounded up some material that we located, that we had collected over a period of time, that first year since our daughter had been born. And I eventually got some information to them, and they were very happy and very thankful that information was disseminated and that they received it. And they eventually called and expressed their appreciation for the fact that I took the time to come there and speak with them, and that they were happy. And that child has now grown up and is now, you know, like 19 years old, 19, 20 years old, something like that. So, and lives at home and is looking for a place to live eventually as an adult. And this story repeated itself hundreds of times since that Motzei Shabbos in 1991, somewhere in there. And eventually I started going to various hospitals and speaking with the staff. I began speaking with nursing staff and social workers, and eventually started meeting like the chief of staff at NYU, the OBGYN, the doctor who delivered all the babies.
Can I ask you, what was the initial response on the part of those healthcare professionals and social workers when you started bringing up this agenda?
Well, they first of all couldn't believe that anybody was really willing to take this on, because you have to understand their prejudice against the religious community at that point, and largely based upon lack of information, the frum community, the religious people in the community, Orthodox Jews, would try to find a place to, you know, send their child and move on with their lives. And they would find any rabbi to give them a heter, an exemption from keeping the child and giving the child away. And by the way, there's always somebody who will tell you something in the world of, you know, of the religious genre. But
right,
the physicians also were negative, and there was also, so you had the physicians that were saying, look, pretty much what they told me a year before that, before I started doing it, you know, find a place to put her and get on with your lives. That's the doctor. Then the father finds a suitable, quote-unquote, rabbi to assist them in making this decision. He says to the mother and the father, listen, I very much would like you to... you know, I think it would be a good idea if you gave this child away and let the child be raised by someone else, because it's going to become too much of a distraction. Now, that's the second thing. Then they run into the parents, the grandparents of the baby, who at that time and before that even, are tinged with a bias against children with Down syndrome because they or their parents remember being in Europe at a time when there was no early intervention or infant stimulation programs, and when there really was no knowledge of what was Down syndrome, and it was like pre even the concept of Mongolism, quote unquote, which I dread using the word, but and so what they wound up, what most people remembered seeing when they were young, when they were in their youth, was a child who lived probably in a one room home that probably had a dirt floor. There was probably a kitchen, dining room, and bedroom all in one area, and you had an infant that was born that was 5-6 years old and still not potty trained. And you have to remember, potty training in those days didn't mean just changing a disposable diaper and putting it in the trash and going back to sleep. It meant a whole process of going outdoors and going to what they had, I guess, were outhouses in the European, in the shtetls, in the villages, and it was probably a communal one that everybody took turns using. It was like one for every so many houses. So they remember raising a child that was 12 or 13 years old before that child even understood what was a toilet and and how to get out. And when that happened, once the child knew how to use a toilet and knew how to, take care of themselves in that way, oftentimes because of the size of the home and because of the kindness and the good-naturedness of the community, many of these children were put out of the home. Because they couldn't speak, they didn't have the early intervention. Infant stimulation did what didn't have, so they didn't have good tactile response. So they grunted, and they became adults who ran around in the community, who put their hands out for food. They didn't know about money. They didn't understand these things. They were literally isolated from everybody, but they were accepted. They knew they could stay within the community, and they would be fed, and they would be cared for, et cetera, et cetera. It sounds very cold-hearted, but when you're talking about a one-room home where there's 12, 13, 14, 18 people living in the home, all parents and children, and eventually even young married people who stayed there sometimes for a few days or a few weeks until it was time to, move on and find their own place. You had this one child that was completely absorbing all of the energy of the entire family.
Right.
And so, I'm not judging them because I can't. And I'm not saying that they did the right thing, because I can't say that either. And I can't say they did the wrong thing. I can only say that if I'm speaking from the voice of that child, what a horrible thing to have happened to that child, which is the thing that is missing in relating this story from the families who remember it happening to them. They just remember that this child grew up in their house, was a complete distraction from everything else that was going on, because the child didn't have proper communication skills, didn't have proper life skills, didn't have proper ability to comprehend what was actually going on. So here you have this child out on the street, and finally the home is back to quote unquote normal, and it's certainly not typical, because at that point the quote unquote damage has been done. Now, fast forward to 1990, 1991, and I'm coming into the hospital and saying, hey, keep this kid. And the rest of the family, the older part of the family, who controls the purse strings, is saying, you ain't keeping this kid. No way. I remember them. And I am now stuck not dealing with just the parents who are upset because I found out about them having a baby in the hospital, but I'm also now trying to interact with and deliver a message to a group of people who are going to tell me that they remember what happened in their family, that when they were children, their parents and grandparents were absolutely overwhelmed by having this child. And I now am going to be challenged to tell them that it's not as difficult as you think. Now, saying that, I'm not going to say that it's not difficult, but it's not as difficult as they think it is, because many things have changed over the years. So as I'm going to these, you asked me about going into the hospital. When I come into the hospital, the hospitals were now stuck with families were coming to them and saying, look, you know, and this is literally what one of the social workers said to me, the social worker actually at NYU. She says, you know, I'm really happy to see that you're doing this. She says, but I just want to know, how are you going to overcome the fact that they don't mind, this is the social worker's view,
right.
I don't mind that you have fun making babies. I do mind that when you have the baby, you dump it on me when it becomes a little bit challenging and abandon it. And I said, that's precisely why I'm here, Judy. Judy was the head of the social workers in the OBGYN at NYU. And from that, we developed the relationship that every time a child was born, and Dr. Clarice, I forgot his last name. Oh, he's going to be so upset with me. I haven't seen him for a while. He's a black Haitian doctor who studied Mishnah every day. So when I would come in to see him, I had to find out from the staff there what he was working on, which parak he was in. And I would have to, and he would always ask me a Mishnah question, a question on Mishnayos. And
right.
I found it so incongruous that I'm sitting here discussing a question in Mishnah that really led us to a Gemara discussion, in order to really fully understand and appreciate the full depth of the questions that he asked. And he sat there. He was so smart and so brilliant that he loved talking, about the Mishnah and the Torah.
Desire.
Yeah, his one, I want to say weakness, but it's not a weakness. I mean,
nah.
Probably a strength, you know. But this is the one thing that he desired more than anything, was he thirsted for the knowledge of the Mishnah. So after we would sit and talk for a few minutes about the Mishnah, he would say, oh, yes, you know, do you talk to Judy? We had another family, he had a baby, and they were from, this one was from Williamsburg, this one was from Union City, another one, came from Long Island, whatever. So the families that were having babies in that hospital, we were pretty much covered with. You know, we had NYU. Then I made inroads, and by the way, from that, Judy developed an understanding of how to approach the families, because I taught her that, look, most of the time a family will say, look, we can't keep this child. And I would say, why? And they would say, well, we've got too many children as it is.
Mm-hmm.
So my first question is, then why did you have another one? You know, I mean, I can't ask it in such a grub way, but my question is, look, you were expecting to have a child. This one turned out to be not the one you expected, but it certainly turned out to be the child you were supposed to have. And that's the difference between, like we discussed earlier in one of the earlier programs, the difference between emunah and betachon. That emunah is, I believe that Hashem's going to give me exactly what I need, and that's what Hashem... But betachon is that Hashem's going to give me what I need, and that what I need will be what I want. And that's the difference between that level. But nonetheless, it doesn't mean that you can eliminate one over the other, and that's pretty much what most people did and do. Well, I haven't seen it happen, thank God, in a long time. But more and more people were coming to the realization that this was indeed a 100% bona fide, fully developed neshama, a soul,
right.
A Jewish soul that was completely attached to every other Jewish soul that ever came before it, that is existing now, and that ever will come after it. And that in giving this child away, and oftentimes they were giving these children away to non-Jewish homes. And my primary concern at that point was, and on a very simple level, first of all, the Jewish people have always been known to take care of themselves.
Right.
We've learned to be very self-reliant, and that and there's a reason for that. Obviously, that was probably one of the main reasons why we've had to go through all these trials and tribulations. We have learned not only to take care of ourselves, but we've learned to take care of the world. And if you look at any hospital in the city of New York, out of hundreds of hospitals, 90% of them were initiated by Jews, by Jewish philanthropy. This is coming from people who have been held down and prevented from attending school, participating in professions, participating fully in the economic development of the world up until the United States of America, and suddenly they're not only making money, but they're giving it back to the community in huge amounts and completely investing. Okay, so my point is that if we can do that for everybody else and we're all totally invested in this, how do we walk away and give our children to someone else to raise? That's number one. Number two, why is it important to me in terms of the neshama, the soul? Even if I say, look, the physicality we can't separate because, as I said earlier, God exists not only in the spiritual realm, but God exists in the physical realm as well, because God is everything, all at the same time.
So you can't find any place devoid of him.
Pardon me?
You cannot find any place devoid of the Creator.
That's right. That's right. Even when I want to be in that place, God forbid. Okay, so what I'm saying is that you can't run and hide. That was the point of that statement. Mm-hmm. That even though we think we can, and even though we think we can give this child to somebody else, and the other person, and I'll go home and I'll rest quietly and comfortably. We have a lady that gave a child away 18 years ago to us, and it's a very interesting story. And if we have time, I'll get into it. But the day she gave that child away until today, I still get phone calls from her in the middle of the night every once in a while. It took her a year. She had to leave New York, and she went to Israel and stayed in a special place for where ladies, you know, go to recover from mental challenges in their lives. And she still isn't over that problem, and her husband isn't aware of the fact that she's not over that problem yet. Because it was, there's two things. First of all, a woman is a Nazir Kenegdo. She's what's a Nazir Kenegdo? Come on, help me out.
The helper who can either correspond or be an adversary for her husband, depending on how she reacts and how he treats her.
That's it. She's either the perpendicular helper or the parallel helper. That's your wife. That's what a wife is.
Yeah.
She's either she's butting your head because you're going the wrong way, or she's your parallel partner and she's going along with what you said because she sees it's right. That's an Azer Kenegdo. That's her Asia style. That, by the way, that's what my wife Hannah has been through all of this, because you have to understand, and you can imagine, this hasn't been an easy parsha for us either, because we're dealing with our own set of situations, and we not only that have to deal with other people's, because we took that on, and we did it, we did it, you know, agreeing to do it, but it definitely has put a strain on our relationship. Now, having said that, having a strain on your relationship doesn't mean that the relationship is going to explode. It just means that you need to learn to work harder. And I have to apologize to her if I haven't worked hard enough or harder over the course of time on our marriage because I was working on other things. I have to say, you know, I'm really sorry about that, because I feel like this has been such a challenge that it has taken a drain on us, and it has pulled us in many directions at many times. But somehow we've managed over all these years to remain happily married. And I'm saying that because I'm living in New York, my wife is living in Yerushalayim, and we're doing this for a reason. Mm-hmm. And we've had some stupid people come over and say, you know, when did you guys get divorced? So I'm just going to say right now, first of all, it's none of your business. Second of all, we didn't do that. We're very happily married, and we're very happily continuing to take on the challenge that we have accepted since before our child was born, Suri. And by the way, Suri is probably listening in. Suri Mushka Goldstock, I want to say hello. Oh, yeah, she's probably listening in now. She's attending.
Wait, we have a phone call, Eliezer. Can we take a phone call?
If you have one to take, sure.
Okay. Caller, can you please identify yourself? You're live on Soul Class number 126, getting to the heart of the matter, Rabbi Eliezer Goldstock.
Hello. I didn't know I was in the queue. I've listened to your show several times. My name is Slahuddin. I live in New York City. I'm not Jewish, but I don't know what
being like the rest of us.
Yes, I was feel somewhat uncomfortable about calling, but no, I just admire the Jewish culture very much, and as the rabbi said, just from my understanding of history, the survival skills of the Jewish people, I think that some of the responses to the success of the Jewish people has been, I think, something of envy. And I think that's what some of the backlash against Jews has been. But, no, I'm just saying that I admire, and I think that there's a lot in the Jewish culture that can, if when others emulate it, not that other cultures don't have some very laudable qualities also, but emulate some of those characteristics can also be successful. I mean, even secular humanism, you know, it was created, founded by the Ethical Culture Society by a Jewish rabbi.
Maslow.
Yeah. Well, Abraham Maslow, yeah, he came out of Brooklyn College. I went to Brooklyn College. Yeah. He's humanistic psychology, yeah, and, you know, the hierarchy of needs. But, you know, there was a Jewish rabbi who created, secular humanism. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to tell you, I'm going to make an admission to you. What was your name? I didn't catch it.
Salahuddin. Sal, you can call me Sal.
Sal.
Sal, first of all, I want to thank you for coming on the show, mm-hmm. and after Eliezer speaks, Rabbi Goldstein speaks, I want to ask you a question, and you're definitely making the show more organic, so take it away, Eliezer.
No, I was just going to say, I want to make an admission to you that, you know, aside from, you know, Maslow and Carl Rogers and what was Mr. Gestalt's name? Fritz Perl.
Fritz Perl, yeah.
I actually have a degree in humanistic psychology. It's almost like I'm ashamed to say it, but thank you very much for bringing that up. The one thing that I took from that, and I think this is what you're bringing out, is that if we understand what the human potential holds, and we start to strive for our human potential, we as a human race on this planet can accomplish so much by not being envious of other people's, what other people have. I think that's one of the Ten Commandments, you know. If we look at everybody as a neighbor,
right,
then we have no permission to covet what the other person has or does. And I'm so happy that you, Sal, that you called in. I really appreciate your honesty and your input and your support. It's very nice to hear. And Don, go ahead. Ask what you. Sal's waiting.
We have a smorgasbord of shows here on SoClass, but you called in and you're listening to the show about empowering those who are not given enough chances in society, atypical children, children born with what normal, quote-unquote, society, whatever normal means, is with a disability. What attracted you to listening to this show, and what is your perceptions on how society treats people who are what we call atypical, who need a little bit more boosting than the rest of us, quote-unquote, typical people?
I just want to say my background, I actually drive a yellow taxi now, but my background is I'm a licensed social worker. LMSW,
uh-huh.
So I have some familiarity with counseling and such, but I think that our society is has become very materialistic and has been that way for a while, and is really disregards those who can't keep a pace. We're a very competitive society, and it seems as though if you're not able to make a contribution in some material way or otherwise, then you're somewhat marginalized. I don't think that we give due regard to see the value in people who can't make some kind of qualitative contribution to society.
Yet we're all born helpless. So why? Where do you think the distinction is made between, we're all born helpless, and then some people who are a little more helpless than others get pushed to the side from a societal perspective and treated, let's face it, like second-class citizens?
Well, yeah, the rabbi said, you know, Alfred Adler's talked about the neonate being born helpless, and, you know, you resolve it by, you know, becoming like Hitlerian and a dictator, or, you know, like somebody like Mother Teresa, and seek to make a contribution to society. So,
right.
You know, I think that, that our society does not, because we're so rapid fire, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that we live in a society that's constantly in a state of flux. We're constantly, you know, we have this sense of wanting to to it's almost like I think with the Herbert Spencer, the you know Darwinian survival of the fittest modality, and I think that that pervades pretty much all of the scholarship in our society. And I think so when it comes to spiritual matters of really delving into people's inherent value, we don't really look at that. We look at more what you can do. You're not a human being, you're a human doing, so to speak. So, yeah, I think that's a big mistake. Right?
Yes.
Perhaps you'd agree, Rabbi. Yes.
You know what, Eliezer, yes. I'd like to just take a step back. I don't, we've got 19 minutes. You and I'd like Sal, as a professional, as a social worker, to listen to you and ask you the question instead of me. I think that will make the show a little more entertaining. So, Eliezer, why don't you continue, and I'll just sit in the back. When we get about 2 minutes to the show, I'll chime in with the conclusion of the show.
Okay, I want to say to Sal that going a step beyond what you were saying here, you know, you see these wonderful people like Mother Teresa, as you alluded to, and others who have done wonderful, grandiose kinds of things, and I think we take the wrong example from them. We think in our society, which is a society, a disposable, instant gratification sort of place, that we've created ourselves in this milieu that we call America and its spread, that we think that the message is that we've got to be as big and as great and wonderful as they are and reach out to as many people as we can. And I think the message is really, if just because somebody else can do this on a grand scale doesn't mean that you doing it one-on-one isn't a grand scale for you. And I think that's the point we miss. As sociologists, I think, you know, everywhere, realize that you don't need to get large groups of people gathered to do anything. You only need them in order to create a movement that will encourage others to participate. And that's the instant gratification. You know, we all think that, look, if we don't get it right now, how many times have you seen this thing, you know, we're almost out of them, you know, call in right now, or, you know, get out, you know, run down and buy this. They're almost gone. And you think, oh, my gosh, they're almost gone. And then you get it home and you say, I really didn't need this. I could have used the money for something else. But we feel like because it's available right now, we've got to get it. And because the availability of the funds in my pocket and, the, you know, like this is the Hashgacha Pratzis, this is the divine providence of the moment that this is available. As a social worker who drives a taxi, you must see this mentality on a daily basis.
Yes.
You know,
yes, Rabbi.
Everybody's in a hurry to get somewhere, and you probably, in your assessment of what's going on, realize there are really a bunch of people going nowhere. Not that I'm not denigrating or diluting the importance of somebody's parnassa, their ability to earn a living, but the truth of the matter is we don't run to do the really important things, do we? We run to do the things that are personal survival. And the lessons that we learn from all of these other, you know, world social leaders of and humanistic involvement really was, look, it may be that I can do a lot of things and I can juggle a lot of things and organize many events and activities and get people doing things. But that may be the only thing, the message I'm getting to you is that try to organize your life in such a way that you can just do this with one person, that you can just add one thing to your life that isn't there now and try to improve one step at a time instead of trying to grab everything. And I think that's pretty much what you're talking to in term about when you say, you know, that everybody is trying to become something that they can't, literally. I mean, I couldn't be... work in Calcutta under the circumstances that Mother Teresa worked under. I wouldn't even pretend to be able to. Would I try it if I was stuck in that situation? I suppose we would all try it. But who would succeed as well as she did at doing what she did? Because she was a very gentle, kind soul and really had nothing else that she was striving to do but to help people. And if in the moment that we're helping people, that's the only thing we're striving to do, then we have achieved a certain level of becoming a helper, so to speak, of you know, God, the creator of this world.
Beautiful.
Let every man,
yes.
Every man should be respected as an individual. Every person should be respected. Every person should be respected as an individual, and no one should be idolized. That's the point.
Hmm.
You know, in other words, if I respect you as an individual, and no matter what you did, I'm not idolizing you. I'm just saying I want to emulate the things that I want to emulate about you. It doesn't mean that I necessarily even like you. You know, but I may like what you do or the way you do something. And that's wherein the humanity of all of this starts to blend in, and we start to realize and accept. Go ahead, Don. I'm sorry for stepping on your toes.
No problem. No, you gentlemen can continue in this mode, or you can go back to what you were saying before about your endeavors to educate families, and then maybe Sal can reflect maybe on some of his experiences. I don't know. Sal, have you had experience working with families or individuals who had a child who was atypical, was born with some sort of, a society would call it, a disability?
Yes.
And how did they react to their being given the responsibility of raising someone who is atypical?
I think a lot of the families when I was working that had a special needs child, the attitude with some of them when they came to counseling was they felt harried, they felt overwhelmed. Some of them felt that God had, and I think this is, you know, the crisis of faith, and those who did have a faith, they felt that God had abandoned them, God had cursed them. And what I did, I'm sure the rabbi, my goodness, was say much, much better than myself, but I tried to help them to see the value in that experience. Like, I mean, I had read years ago, even before, you know, the Viktor Frankl's, you know, Man's Search for Meaning, and, you know, and as Rabbi said, you know, that even in the small things, you can see some good in it, and not just some good, that there may be something monumentally good and something infinitesimally small, you know, insignificant as you perceive it. So there may be gold to be mined here, but even then, so I think that was the major issue, trying to get, you know, help the person, the client who came in, usually the parents, to reconcile, you know, how to interact with this child, and so a lot of them did it grudgingly, and they felt guilty about it. So there was a lot of guilt that they had, the shame sometimes of the child, and of course that reflected negatively on the child, and of course the child can sense that. So usually a child, if they have cognitive deficiencies in terms of retardation, that usually I wouldn't have to deal with play therapy with the child himself. But in that case, much of the parent's input was most relevant to how well the child fared and how the healing process of the child, that would be mostly a focus on the parents, because the child really couldn't fend for itself very much because of their deficiencies or perceived or special needs, if you will. Try not to, you said Maslowian, you know, Carl Rogers, not to devalue, even in my terminology, try not to devalue the person.
You know, it's funny as you mentioned this, I'm thinking, I don't know why it never hit me before, but the parents are really the ones who need the play therapy, aren't they?
Oftentimes, yes, Don. Yes, Rabbi, right? Yes.
Because they really can't decipher out what's really bothering them and what they want it to be really bothering them. You know, everybody has this certain, you know, it's a funny thing, you know, when you talk about God abandoned them. I'm always reminded of a story of a friend of mine that, I mean, it's a true story, and it's been published many times. He was late for an appointment. He ran to the airport and was in the waiting area. The plane had been delayed like 10 minutes or something. So he sat down, and he was, you know, reading something, and all of a sudden they announced the flight, so he, you know, grabbed his stuff, and he ran onto the plane. And he gets on the plane, and they said, you know, they're taking. And he looked over, and he realized he forgot his tefillin. You know what tefillin are? Phylacteries.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. I just.
Yes, yes.
I'm not. I don't know, because not everybody who isn't Jewish knows what that is. But thank you. So,
not everyone who's Jewish knows what it is.
My wife is Jewish for 15 years. Yeah. So.
Oh. Okay.
Yes.
Your wife of 15 years, or she?
Yes,
you're
a Schreiber family, right?
Huh?
Yes.
So, okay, so he realized, and he told the stewardess, and the stewardess says, look, you know, we're just closed the doors, you know. She says, if you get off, you won't be able to get back on. He says, look, I have to have the tefillin. You know, he's not going anywhere. I don't know if you know, but tefillin, while being very important spiritually, also cost like, you know, $1,500 a pair today. So there, and if you use two pair like many of us do, or even four pair, the fellow is like, has to get off the plane. So the stewardess made a call and whatever, and made arrangements, and he got off the flight, and he realized he's now not only going to be late, he's going to miss a very important appointment. And that plane was the second plane that went into the Twin Towers. It's a very famous story.
Wow.
That fellow, because he forgot his tefillin and was very upset about the whole thing, and yet, long term, we see that, you know, the overall picture of the flight was it saved his life. So when a person comes to the realization that, or comes to the thought process that God abandoned them, it's only in that moment that you really feel that. And truthfully, the overall picture of everything is that that it will eventually come out the way it's supposed to. And as we said before, if it's just emunah, then he would have stayed on the plane and said, okay, they'll find it and keep it for me. If it's bitachon, you know, he had to get off the plane because he realized that this moment came to him, but he still has to show what really means something to him in terms of the spiritualness. And it, again, has nothing to do with the fact that they were very expensive. It's just that he wouldn't have had them where he was going, to New York. And that's a very difficult thing to know, because it's so important in the lives of a Jew, using them every day as we do. So I use that as an example. I always say, you know, when you miss a flight, you know, Gam Zulatov, this is also for the good. We never know why we missed the flight, but, you know, they try to make the best of the situation. And truthfully, that's what you're saying about these families, that they're mad at God. They're literally mad at God, because how could God do? And I want to tell you something. I'll be very honest with you. When this happened to us, my wife and I had, you know, our daughter 21 years ago, we looked at each other, and you know, and the first thought that went through our minds was, how could this be happening to us? This happens to other people. It doesn't happen to us. You know, you do. You develop a certain arrogance that God takes away from you and makes you realize that, you know, hey, look, you know, you think you're such a hotshot. You're not. You're just like everybody else. Anything can happen to anyone at any time. So when I say to somebody, help us, support us, and they say, eh, you know, I don't do that, I don't deal with that, you know, I can't tell you how many times, and I'm not saying, God forbid, I'm not even saying that this has anything to do with punishment, but at all. It just happened to be their turn. But I've seen those people wind up coming back and saying, look, I'm making a big donation. Why? Oh, well, you know, my daughter or my granddaughter, whatever, had a child who was born with Down syndrome. And the only reason I'm saying that is because it's in connection with the concept of divine providence. It happened to be that I had asked them. They were, like I was, very arrogant about the whole thing. How could this be happening to me? How could this happen to us? You know, and yet, you know, we eventually learned acceptance on a grand scale. And I think my wife, it'll be 40 years this year, has accepted and did accept and loves our children. And she was the one, I think, who really fully got into that acceptance modality much faster, much easier than I did, because it's the mother. And I think when you look at your Azer Kenega, if she's going along with you but also butting your head, find out why she's butting your head so you can make her walk along with you.
We have about 6 minutes left, and Sal, we have about 6 minutes left. I'd like to ask you, Sal and Eliezer, Sal, when you've dealt with families that had faith, did they seem to be more flexible in dealing with the situation with an atypical child, or were they, is it 50-50 between them and, say, a family that wasn't talking about their faith-based perspectives on how to deal with this situation?
I think the people who had some faith, actually, it was easier for them to try and to find some meaning in the situation, and I think the people who didn't have faith, they had, I think, a more difficult time. they didn't have a belief system. They weren't. They were more objective in terms of the situation, and more. They looked at things from a very practical and functional how it somehow inhibited their happiness. They wanted to have children. I remember one was telling me that she looked forward to having a child that she could be proud of. And
yeah.
She stated emphatically that I'll never be proud of this child. And she broke down and cried. And I said she was crying not just for herself, but also for the child.
Wow.
She felt, again, that guilt that she was so, on a deep, visceral level, she really, I wouldn't say she didn't love her child, but she just didn't, she was having difficulty connecting with it, and she felt such shame and guilt. So I think the people who have some faith, that love that they have for God and the divine nature, that they could find it was a bit easier to kind of transfer some of that, or even most of it, to the child. They saw easy for them to see purpose in the situation.
That is a very typical, normal type of response, though, from a mother,
yes,
who initially hears that their child is not going to meet up to their expectations, their initial expectations, and they're going to have to adjust the sights on their lifetime targets. You know, we understand that we don't put our trust in man. Anybody who puts their trust in man and relies on human mortals has literally turned themselves away from the creator of everything and the one who continues to hold the whole process up and make it work. And when you say that the people who had a belief system in understanding that the world is the way it is, and it's an honest and true assessment of the way life is, and that we also understand that you can't put your trust only in the opinion of man. There has to be something outside of man, above man, beyond man, that tells us the difference between right and wrong and good and evil. Because if your system, your personal system of right and wrong, says you can cheat, lie, and steal, and mine says you can't cheat, lie, and steal, but you can kill, that's the way I believe. that's my system. But if we all believe in the virtues of a creator who says to us, gives us the moral standards and values of what it is we should do and we shouldn't do, we know right from wrong, then we have a basis, a jumping off point that we can all touch and agree upon. But can I just give a quick message?
Go ahead.
How to reach heart to heart? Because I see
by
the old clock on the wall. It's not really old, and it's not on the wall, but I just said that. Anyhow, heart to heart can be reached at 718-778-0111. And for those people who have tried to reach me, I've heard about, we didn't set up the machinery yet, as I had mentioned before. We're working on it. Hopefully this week that'll all be done. Heart to Heart American, www.hearttoheartamerican.org. We're punching up and upgrading our website as I speak. You can reach me at Rabbi Eliezer Goldstock on Facebook, or Heart to Heart American Jewish Society for Distinguished Children on Facebook as well. And I just want to wish everybody a wonderful week, and I want to thank Sal for taking the time to come on and speak with us.
Thank you.
It takes a lot of courage just to pick up a phone and call a total stranger in the middle of the morning, and a fellow New Yorker at that, and look how nice he is.
Yeah, nice New Yorker. I'm from Connecticut, Sal, and, New Yorkers are nice, but you're one of the nicer ones.
Listen, you're two mensches, two tzaddiks, and I feel really humbled to be in your presence. I mean that.
I'm humbled by your wisdom, your faith in God, and your fellowship this morning, and hopefully next week, Sal, Rabbi Goldstock and I will be back on the air from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Maybe you can share it with a friend. I want to let you know as well that I have different shows. I have three shows during the week. You're definitely a welcome guest, and maybe one day you'll become a co-host on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, we had Rabbi Eliezer Goldstock from Heart to Heart Perikin. This is Don Goodman signing off. We're going to end off with Moshe Rabbeinu's hands. The hands of Moses helps us get through the day because he was connected to the Most High. Take care, everyone.
Shalom Aleichem.
Thank you.